It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for September 18th, 2021. Today, we're going to the movies. The Bicycle Film Festival, which is celebrating its 20th year, has been screening films virtually since last year when everything was shut down. With over 50 cities already screening films this year, Cleveland is up this week. Beginning this past Friday, September 17th, you can purchase a ticket good for the entire week and log on to see the 90 minutes of short, curated films. We're going to talk with the Film Festival's owner and founder, Brent Barber, about what you will see this week and how to get your front row seat. Then it's off to the UK for the conversation I promised you 2 weeks ago. Phil Cavell is one of the founders of CycleFit and the author of the new book, The Midlife Cyclist, The Roadmap for the Plus 40 Rider Who Wants to Train Hard, Ride Fast, and Stay Healthy. And we're going to explore it all. So first, it's off to New York City for a chat with Bicycle Film Festival's Brent Barber. Hi, Brent. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest. How are you? It's been a while since we spoke.
Hi, I'm doing very well, thank you, and it's nice to be back on the show.
Well, it's nice to have you back. And so your trusty, dusty assistant, she's awesome, Mandy, sent me a message that we're premiering here in Cleveland for the 20th anniversary of the Bicycle Film Festival. And so I thought we'd catch up, see what's been going on since I talked to you in February, which it seems like it was longer ago than that, but then time has just been really weird. And then what the film festival here in Northeast Ohio is going to look like. So tell us what's been going on since February.
We've been on a mission. We haven't stopped. We, since last October, have produced 85 events virtually.
Wow.
Just like a lot of folks, we were hoping to by now host a physical event. And particularly in New York, our home base, we would hope to really celebrate our 20th anniversary, which was last year. And the Cleveland's going to be at the tail end of this virtual tour, showing some of our greatest hits, films that short films, a short form program of films from the last few years that really some touching stories and exciting stories and inspiring stories, all on the bicycle.
Do you think you're going to be able to start doing live events again soon?
We have done one, and that was, we have two planned. We have one and have one other plan. One was in Waterloo, and that was produced by the bicycle-loving cinema owner, John Tutt, in Waterloo, Canada. He owned the cinema, and there were restrictions. It was at half capacity. And so since it was half capacity, we ran one film program. You have to understand, Bicycle Film Festival, normally we've had up to 15 film programs. But for this, we've been really small. So we just ran one film program over a number of days to half capacity. We had planned on doing a physical festival in November. We're like, we got to do this. We got it. And we felt like things were looking good this summer. And then as soon as we were ready to announce it, I went to a Zoom call for this organization that has big, huge venue owners, famous venues, comedy clubs, dance clubs, nightclubs, all kinds of nightlife and arts and dance, every Broadway, and it was a big, big Zoom call of hundreds of people. And everyone was talking about how they're canceling again their events. And I was like, oh, gosh, because they didn't know. And everyone was saying sponsors are backing out. So I said, okay, we're going to do New York. We're just going to do it online in December. And if we can, in a nimble manner, come up with a couple of during the month of December, which is a kind of awkward time to do events due to the holidays, if we can come up with a free outdoor screening or, you know, some type of safe event, we may just do that. But it is cold, and maybe something like a bike ride. We don't know. We just know that right now, that as a company, we're very grateful. We have our staff on board, and we've hired new people, and we've had the support, particularly in North America, some incredible organizations and the community at large. We've hosted over 20,000 people online, you know, buying tickets. That's been really good for us. We're still living in COVID. I think that a lot of people now, things have moved on for them, depending on people's situation. Everyone's in a different place. And we're still living through it because we can't do a physical event safely. And also, we can't afford the risk. If we put all that manpower, so to speak, woman power into an event that's in 3-6 months. I mean, normally it takes us a year to do a larger event. And then also sponsorships, you know, really important in a big expensive cities like New York or Los Angeles. You know, you're talking a lot of money just to open the doors, which we are very confident that people are going to come out once we do the physical event, because we're getting a lot of inquiries about it. It's just, when is that moment, and how do we measure our risks? The decision not to do the festival in New York, which happened quickly after that meeting, and I called back to like a staff Zoom call because people are all over the place on our team. And it was because we don't want to go through what we went last year, which was, we had organized our 20th anniversary for New York last June, and we had booked our band, the venues, you know, and obviously we, all that work, that 15 months of work, it was gone, and we lost all the income, which is one thing, but they also, we missed our 20th anniversary, which we felt was going to be like a reunion. You know, there's a large community that's been involved in the Bicycle Film Festival for years, and there were, people had bought their flight to come to New York. And so I think we just kind of, during this, we kept on thinking that this was going to happen. Once, you know, we're doing the virtual, and then we're waiting for the moment we can actually bring back the 20th anniversary, you know, screenings. And I think that we're just going to let that go. We're going to kind of end that on this virtual tour by the end of the year. We're going to keep doing the virtual tour. We're getting new films in now, and that will start off with New York in December. So
good. Well, let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then we'll talk a little bit about the film festival that actually is opening this week in Cleveland. We're speaking with Brent Barber. He is the, I guess you're the owner of the Bicycle Film Festival, and it's been 20 years. We talked to him back in February about what was happening with the film festival. It is still online, but we are expecting to see lots of films here in Cleveland. Tell us how long the Cleveland Festival is going to run, and then how the virtual tour works.
It's September 17th to 26th. So it's just very simple. You can purchase a ticket at bicyclefilmfestival.com, the ticket page. You can just hit the Bicycle Film Festival Cleveland button, and you will buy the ticket at a sliding scale of $10, $15, or $20, whatever you like. And you will receive a link that will give you a confirmation that you've bought the ticket, but then you will receive a link 15 minutes before the starting time on Friday, the 17th. And you can watch that program anytime between then and the 26th. So, and it's just one short film program, and you can watch it twice. You can watch it three times if you want. Some people have actually, but that's available to you. So the door is open to that portal with that link for the admission. You know, I'm not totally encouraging this, but people have been having, it's been nice to see pictures of people with their families, their roommates, their friends, watching the screenings together. We are obviously not with the people other than this, but it's been nice. People have been tagging us on their Instagram stories, and we'll repost them. So we're feeling that people are, you know, enjoying this, and, you know, drinking a glass of wine or having a beer. It's a nice moment to take for yourself. I know we were all a little bit screened out, But if you make this, you make this your time and watch it all at once and sit, you know, like kind of make a, you know, make some popcorn, you know, like sit back. Yeah. You know, take time and really enjoy, sit back and let the program, we've curated a program for you. You know, like you could go on YouTube and find a bunch of bike movies and that's fine. That's fun. But that's kind of like wandering. But this is like, you just, you kind of focus and see this, you know, it's a nice way to come into, even if there's a cinemas open wherever you may be in Ohio, you could still, you know, enjoy this at home.
I was just going to ask you if you could highlight a couple of the films that we'll be seeing.
Oh yeah, this program. So this is an interesting thing about this program. Normally in the physical world, we have like the road cycling screening. We have adventure cycling, you know, bike packing, you know, people have been riding. There's like thousands of people right now riding all around the world, and we have films about them. And or like the bike messengers and BMX street culture, which is tons of fun to go to in the cinema. I like to think a lot of cyclists are like you and I, we love it all, but some cyclists prefer other things. And like, so how do we fit that in? And what we had to do with programming is we really had to focus on the human story. So we have there is a film about a guy in Nigeria, a young guy who went to an internet cafe and saw on someone's screen BMX. He saw a bike in, you know, being sold, and he's like, I want to get one of those, and started learning through the internet, like, oh my gosh, there's this whole world. And so that was the beginning of the BMX movement in Nigeria. But it's what's really comes through in this, especially, you know, we're talking to some Americans, is that like the joy of cycling can happen anywhere within a country that is impoverished, you know, or it doesn't matter. It's just that the bike still is that same thing for all of us. It's just this like joy, you know, and it could be transportation. It could be your job. It can be, you know, your weekend escape, or it could be your, you know, your competitive self and discipline. But it is that joy for a lot of us. And you can see that with, it's just fascinating to see that story. And I think anybody can, even if you're not into BMX, you could really get enthusiastic about that. You know, there's a little short about Connie Carpenter. She's a great hero in American cycling. She was the first woman to win a gold at 1984 Olympics. And there's a little portrait of her. There is a film about a woman from Ghana who now lives in Amsterdam, and she wants to give back by teaching women refugees how to ride bikes. You know, and it's such a great tool anywhere. In Amsterdam, it's almost like obligatory that you have a bicycle to be part of society. So that's, and by the way, that sounds like a great story. I want to see that. But Mama Agata is her name. She just lights up the screen. She has so much charm, so much personality, just a wonderful person. Last year, there was a ride. In fact, it happened again this year, but this film is just a short from that. And there was a ride during the Black Lives Matter period. Hopefully it still goes in one form or another. But like there was a bike ride to Washington, D.C. from New York City to commemorate the anniversary of Martin Luther King's speech on Washington. So that was pretty cool. And it's just a little short snack, I would say, that film. So that, you know, there's something for everybody in this screening, and we've been getting really amazing feedback, and yeah, I hope people enjoy it.
Me too. Well, there are quite a few films listed. You can find out more at bicyclefilmfestival.com. We've been speaking with Brent Barber. He is the owner of the Bicycle Film Festival. Happy 20th anniversary, even though it sort of is past and you're celebrating it now. But I'm going to encourage everybody to go online. So let me ask you a question. People are listening from other areas. They can go online and watch the Cleveland Film Festival too, right?
Absolutely. We didn't geotag. But through the promotions, this is a beautiful thing, actually. We are working with Bike Cleveland and so many different organizations within the bicycle community of Cleveland and all over this country. We have now worked with, since we started last October, 2,500 small businesses and local organizations. It's been quite remarkable. In fact, I would venture to say that we probably have one of the best databases for bicycle culture in the United States. You know, so it's just that we had to bring in stakeholders and work with folks to get the word out through this loud space called the internet. So it's been really nice, and I'm super grateful. Like we cannot complain. You know, it's just been so great. And so, yes, to answer your question, we see that about over 90% of the ticket sales will be from Cleveland and the greater Cleveland area or Northeast Ohio. But then you'll see random tickets, like maybe someone used to live in Cleveland and now they live in the Philippines or something, you know. And we've got those kind of emails like, I want to go to, when are you guys doing this city? Because I used to live there and I now live in Germany or something. It's kind of funny. Or they just randomly select that city to go to. So we see that there's a worldwide audience for each place. It's localized, it's not necessarily localized by the films, but it's localized by the community that comes behind it. We have logos of all the small businesses and organizations that are partnering with us. And it's nice to see, especially in a time like this, all the small businesses being involved. And it's been nice too, because we haven't really been working to get big corporate sponsorships. Normally Bicycle Film Festival were to pay for the festival. It's quite expensive. And like our business model has been trying to get the Nikes or the Pumas or the Bacardis or the banks or what have you. And this has been really refreshing. We're just working with exchange, with supporting each other, so to speak, in different cities that we're going to. Cities, so to speak, because it is virtual.
Well, it's going to be fun to have it in Cleveland. Again, it is actually, this will air on Saturday, so it's already started. You can get your ticket, bicyclefilmfestival.com. Your ticket is good between now and the 26th. So if you're interested in seeing the Bicycle Film Festival, there are a bunch of films that sound like a lot of fun. And Brent, thank you so much for talking with me. Good luck. I hope you get to do some in-person events eventually. I think that maybe we'll get it under control someday.
I like to think, I'm being optimistic. I like to think that next year we're going to have a big giant party in a few cities around the world celebrating bikes.
That would be wonderful. Well, thank you so much and have a wonderful rest of 2021.
Thank you, Diane.
All right. Brent Barber is the founder and owner of the Bicycle Film Festival. To get your ticket to the Cleveland screenings, log on to bicyclefilmfestival.com and click tickets. Then scroll down to find the link for Cleveland. Oh, and don't forget the popcorn. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with bike fitter and author Phil Cavell. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. A bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Are you a micro adjuster or a macro absorber? Are you flexible and hypermobile or stiff and unbending? These are some of the ways Phil Cavell, professional bike fitter and author of the new book, The Midlife Cyclist, The Roadmap for the Plus 40 Rider Who Wants to Train Hard, Ride Fast, and Stay Healthy, asks and answers as we describe his thinking about being a midlife cyclist. Oh, and please excuse the rattling of the paper in the second part of our conversation. I take notes and needed to turn the page. Hello, Phil. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for inviting me on your program. I'm flattered to be involved.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. And so you are in the UK and we are here in the States. And I want to talk about your background first, and then we'll talk about your new book. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and some of your cycling history and how you came to write this really interesting book. It's fascinating, by the way.
Thank you. So I was a bike racer and I wasn't a professional. I wasn't particularly good. I got to what's called first cat level in the UK, probably similar in the US, which meant I was okay, but I was never going to be professional. I wasn't going to pack up and join the circus. So I was good, but I wasn't great. And then I had a very bad injury. That's my big dog barking.
Well, it's either yours or mine.
Okay, it's mine. I could see him running off into the distance. So then I had a bad injury, and it got me thinking about how the bike and the body interface. And I suddenly realized that I'd never actually considered how they interface before. I just took it for granted. I set my bikes up always the same. And as the years ticked over and as the training ticked over, I just set them up the same until I got really badly hurt. And then that made me reconsider things. And then I met Ben Cerotta over 20 years ago now, the great legend Ben Cerotta. And I was actually in San Diego testing an Otro for a magazine that I wrote for. And then I went and took a fit course with Ben over 20 years ago now. We became very close friends. And that was the start of looking at things a bit differently, really, you know, not taking everything for granted, but questioning first principles all the time. And that sort of led me to working with my own clients for a couple of decades in a company called CycleFit, which I share with a very good friend of mine, Julian Wall, who's also a good friend of Ben Cerotta's. And working with our clients got us interested in the subject of what happens to the middle-aged body as you stress it with training and racing, and as you tick on the years, you know, what's actually happening on a biological level and how we can do things differently, better. And so the book's been in gestation for a long, long time. And it's just lockdown gave me the opportunity to sit down and stick all those thoughts onto paper, really.
Well, it's a really interesting book. I think it's one that most of my listeners who are going to fall within the range of what this book covers will be interested in reading. Let's give it the title. It's The Midlife Cyclist, The Roadmap for the Plus 40 Rider Who Wants to Train Hard, Ride Fast, and Stay Healthy. And I think that stay healthy part, given what the last year and a half have been like, is really important right now. So what is so different? What changes and on what kinds of levels as we age?
Yeah. So that is the question. And there's still a lot about aging that's not known. So let's get that out there right now. I mean, the holy grail obviously is to try and reverse aging so we live longer or live forever. So much is not known about aging, but things are known about aging. For example, it's a fact that we have what's called senescence, or the, you know, cells are dying. So we're aging at a cellular level, and we experience aging as we look in the mirror, or we feel a bit more creaky, a bit more pained in our joints, etc. But aging is actually happening at a cellular level, and it's a headwind which we're kind of almost, you know, we're fighting against. So, you know, we age on a hormonal level. So for a male, our testosterone will peak quite young, and then it'll sort of start to decline more than moderately past 30. And for women, of course, and our decline is quite linear. So our testosterone levels will decline at a fairly linear rate then through the rest of our life. For women, of course, it's not like that. You know, you have the perimenopause and the menopause, and these are kind of big hormonal changes. And then we have sarcopenia, which is where we're losing muscle fiber as we age. Again, a natural process where we're losing fibers. And, you know, that's a quite a natural thing. But as an athlete, if you want to try and stay fit and healthy and strong, it's a headwind that you want to offset. And then there's also things like bone mineral loss. So we're, you know, how dense our bones are, bone minerality is declining, reaches its peak at 30 and then starts to decline. Again, it's something that can be offset, but it's a natural process, a natural headwind that we need to battle into, if you like.
Well, you're talking about natural processes. And I know that we talk about how to stay healthy, eating right, exercise, a lot of sleep, and all of that. But see, I told you.
Our dogs are talking to each other.
Yes. What kind of dog do you have?
I have a golden retriever.
And I have what's called a Eurasia, and both of them, I'm sure, are just as nuts. Anyway, but I want to know how aging affects the bike from fit to performance.
Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Phil Burt, who you may or may not heard of. So Phil is a colleague of mine, did the fitting for Sky and British Cycling. He's a physiotherapist. He spoke at one of our conferences that, in fact, I think Ben was at. And he talked about riders falling into two camps, really, micro-adjusters and macro-absorbers. Micro-adjusters are kind of the princesses and the peas, or the princes and the peas. You know, the kind of, you know, the ones that everything, every tiny little change is tracked and charted and felt and experienced, normally in a negative way. And the macro absorbers are the ones who can be given the wrong bike off the team car and not even notice that the saddle's 4 centimeters too low. And they've got somebody else's shoes on and they'll race to the end of the stage, probably win, and never know it ever happened. And there's and in the pro peloton, there's great examples of both of those types, micro adjusters and macro absorbers. Now, if you think of that as a spectrum, you know, micro adjuster, macro absorber, your listeners can think where they are on that spectrum. Most of us are somewhere in, you know, towards the middle of the bell curve. But some of your listeners will be thinking, you know, do you know what? I definitely am a micro adjuster. And then the other ones can be like, yeah, I must be a macro absorber. I never feel anything. But I think it's true to say that as we age, even you're going to turn left on the spectrum. So even if you're a macro absorber, you're completely tolerant of everything. Nothing ever hurts. Every change is absorbed and by your body. But as you age, there's a tendency for you to become more of a micro adjuster. Your tolerances start to narrow. Your bullseye becomes smaller. And that's just a natural process of changes in your body. Your muscular changes, skeletal changes, tendon changes. Diana interrupts you.
No. That's okay. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Phil Cavell. He is the author of The Midlife Cyclist, the roadmap for the plus 40 rider who wants to train hard, ride fast, and stay healthy. We're talking about micro adjuster and macro absorber. And I certainly fall into that micro adjuster category. I am the princess and the pea. So every little thing either affects me or not. Once I get comfortable, don't mess with my fit, right? So I guess I want to know what happens that causes you to begin making that left turn toward the micro adjusting, you know, besides the fact that we just age, are there other things that affect that?
Yeah. So train, you know, as you train more and as you ride more, you know, you're putting stresses onto your body. And those stresses need antidotes. So, you know, if you stress your body, you know, you also need to put more positive aspects into your body. So if you need to stretch more, you need to do more strength and conditioning, you need to be careful about your nutrition, you need to absolutely change and refine your sleep patterns. So all these things will change the way your body reacts to an exercise dose. And the more you dose your body with exercise, the more, you know, the more stress, potential stress is there, and the more careful you have to be that your body is actually in some kind of equilibrium that you were talking about, where, you know, once your bike fit's set, don't change it unless there's a very good reason to change it. But the fact is your body is never in, you know, your body is never stationary. You know, your body is changing all the time, every second of every day. Your body is fighting to keep itself in what's called homeostasis or equilibrium, but it's not. Every single thing you do to your body has a positive or a negative effect. It's not neutral. Everything you eat will have an effect. In that sense, every single thing you do with your body is not neutral. It will have an effect. And the idea behind the midlife cyclist is as you get older, you need to make sure you've got more things in the positive column than you probably did when you were 25, when you could have a whole load of things in the negative column and still go and win a race. That isn't going to happen at 55 when it did happen probably at 25. And that's kind of the point, if you see what I'm saying.
I have a devil's advocate question.
I like those.
I know. We're on that same page. So why the bike? Let's say as opposed to running or swimming or skiing, what is it about the bike that makes it, this is my opinion too, more conducive to you being able to perform at a higher level as you get older?
That is a good devil's advocate question. And in a way, if I can just answer it in two parts, the first part is that it doesn't traumatize the body. Running is a great exercise in terms of building bone minerality. You know, it's essential actually in a way to do something that kind of does provoke, you know, micro trauma to the muscle and the bone and provokes these changes. But the bike doesn't traumatize it. You can do a hard ride one day and you can go out and do a hard ride the next day, because then you just don't have this micro trauma in the muscle. You haven't traumatized the body in that sense. Now, that's both good and bad, Diane. It's good because you can kind of, you know, brick on brick, stack on stack, go and do rides and get yourself fit and strong without traumatizing your body. But your body actually does need a bit of trauma. It does need a bit of strength and conditioning. It does need a bit of running. It does need a bit, you know, you do need this kind of chaos in your exercise diet that cycling doesn't give you because it's so predictable. Now, so it is brilliant. It's soft on the joints. It doesn't adversely load the body up if you're in a good position. So it's good in that sense, but it doesn't test the body in other ways. And one of those ways is creating bone minerality. Now, that's why in the book I say, as you get older, counterintuitively, you need to do less cycling. You actually need to bring other things into your exercise diet. It's not enough on its own. It may have been enough when you were 25, 35. It won't be enough at 55 to preserve health. You'll need to do other things. You'll need to do yoga. You'll need to do something that's kind of load-bearing, Nordic walking or running, or you need to do strength and conditioning work. It won't be enough on its own.
Do you recommend weight training?
I do. I prefer the word resistance training, Diane, but yes, I do. I think it has to be done in the right way. I think this is where I think I'm not a strength and conditioning coach, so I should know my boundaries. But yes, I do. I think resistance training is really, really important for midlife cyclists, both men and women, frankly.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk to Phil about fit, because fit is my middle name. We are talking with Phil Cavell. He is the author of The Midlife Cyclist, the roadmap for the plus 40 rider who wants to train hard, ride fast, and stay healthy. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Actress Allison Sweeney for American Humane.
For more than 100 years, American Humane Association has been teaching kids to be kind to animals. Those in our homes, on the farms, on the silver screen, and wildlife conservation caring for the world's vanishing creatures. But we can't do it alone. Visit kindness100.org to find ways to teach kids how they can make a more caring and humane world for all of us.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we are talking to Phil Cavell. He is a fit guru, and I'm going to use that term because I have been reading up about you. So right at the beginning of the book, you talk about dying, mentioning children seem to be able to talk there about dying and wrap their heads around it, and perhaps much better than adults. You have a chapter called Will I Die? Tell us what that's about, because I'm sure that's going to scare the you-know-what out of people.
You think? Do you know what? Yeah. I meant the title of that chapter to be irreverent, so slightly humorous, slightly tongue-in-cheek. I mean, the book is meant to be, I mean, I think the whole book is written with a slight irreverent air. I mean, that's how I kind of, you know, and Will I Die was deliberately irreverent. It's like, you know, you can dress these things up and soften them, but let's just call it what it is. You know, I'm 60 almost and, you know, a few months away. So I'm a lot closer to dying than I was, you know, 25 years ago. So we should be adult enough to think about it and call it what it is and have discussions about it. My daughter, you know, I remember talking about dying to her when she was very, very young. And, you know, and we would look at animals together, or a bird that had died, or a little snake that had died, and we'd pick it up and we'd look at, you know, look at its lifeless body and talk about it. And that's how she came to understand dying and accept it on a biological level, what it was. This animal had existed, and it existed, you know, it didn't exist anymore. It had died. And she's fairly matter of fact about death. And children can be quite matter of fact about death. And this chapter is designed to be like, well, let's try and take our cue from them. Let's be matter of fact about this and look at the science and deal with the science and what the science tells us. And how, you know, death is something we should fundamentally avoid if we can, and see if science can help us do that. So the title was meant to be irreverent, but also it is meant to be a serious look at what our risks are. And if those risks seem to be different for men and women, and they do seem to be different for men and women. So I'm not sure that answers your question.
Well, let's talk a second about the risks. So the risks are different for men and women. And it's so interesting that things just sort of come together. You talk about tracking plaques. And this week, I don't know if you get his e-zine. He's in his 80s. His name is Dr. Gabe Merkin. And he was talking about stabilizing plaques with exercise and possible statins. So let's talk about that, because it seems to be more of a male issue than female issue, if I'm not mistaken. But what about plaques, and who's most likely to experience a heart attack because of them?
So plaques are atherosclerotic masses in your arteries, coronary arteries. And you're right. So they can cause heart attacks, but plaques can have different morphologies, different substances. So you can have a calcified plaque, or you can have a soft fatty plaque, or you can have a mixed morphology plaque. Now, the ones that are the real problem are the soft or mixed morphology ones. And your guy is absolutely right, I think. As I understand it, exercise plays the role of a statin and takes a mixed morphology or soft plaque, and over time makes it more stable, and because it's more calcified. So part of the scare stories around exercising, where they cause, you know, the athletes seem to have more plaques, but that isn't enough information. You need to look at the actual consistency of the plaques. Calcified plaques are not necessarily a problem because they can't rupture. Mixed morphology plaques or soft plaques are more liable to rupture. So I think that's what your guy was talking about, Dr. Gabe Merkin. That's what he was saying. He was saying it's possible to change the morphology of the plaque over time with exercise. And as I understand it, that's quite right. Exercise can play a role like a statin, which is making the plaque more stable.
Can you prevent them? Can you actually prevent plaques from forming?
That's a really good question. And I mean, there was some research done from back in the 50s. I think it was USA research. Don't quote me on this, because I'm just speaking off the top of my head now, you know, about soldiers, you know, like, who were quite young. And there was the even signs of like 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old guys who had the early sort of signs of, you know, of coronary heart disease. So very, very young. So maybe not. I mean, you know, maybe that just is part of getting old. But what you can do is minimize the impact of them by staying healthy, eating properly, and making dietary adjustments. And if you're a new or returning, so if you're somebody who's always exercised, maybe that your exposure to risk is different than somebody who is brand new to exercise or returning to exercise. And I think I break it out in the book. If you're somebody who's new to hard exercise, you know, you should go and see your family doctor and say, listen, you know, I'm 45, 50 years old. I fancy cycling, and I fancy cycling in group is pretty hard. You know, what should I do? What's the minimum I should do to make sure that I'm, you know, I'm prepared for this? And I do say that in the book, you know, that's if you're new or returning to exercise, that's kind of what you should do. So, I'm babbling now. Sorry, Diane.
You're allowed to babble all you want. This is your show. So let's talk about fitting. It's one of my favorite topics. Some people, as you say, can jump on a bike and nothing hurts, and they can ride in blue jeans and sneakers, and they're good all day. And there are other people like me who really are very sensitive to misfit. So what are some of the important factors, in your opinion, as someone ages, to look for in fitting so that you don't either exacerbate existing problems or don't cause new ones?
That's such a great question. So let me ask that question by asking you a question. Are you or have you been in your life a hypermobile person?
So go ahead and define that for me.
Okay, well, there's a 9-point test, I think it is, for hypermobility. But would you describe yourself as an excessively mobile person? Range, you know, big ranges in your joints, in your the way your back moves. Can you bring your thumbs back against your wrist? You know, are you somebody who's so? If you're somebody, and you said that you're a yoga teacher, right, Diane?
I am. So I do a lot of yoga.
Yeah. So hypermobility, and again, like the whole micro adjuster, macro absorber spectrum, mobility is a spectrum. And we, you know, when we look at our clients, we kind of imagine them on that spectrum. So hypermobile people, right on one end of the spectrum, and right people right on the other end of the spectrum who are very, very limited in flexibility, are generally going to have challenges with fit. Hypermobiles are going to be challenges with fit, possibly because they could just never get comfortable. They're always looking for joint end range for stability. They're always moving and fidgeting around. They can't get comfortable. So somebody who's super stiff on the other end, you know, just struggles to get their body into a position that the bicycle demands. So we tend to look at clients like that, you know. So you overlay the spectrum of macro absorber, micro adjuster with hypermobility and how mobile they are. And you test these things. You test someone's mobility. You test their stability. And as one gets older, you know, there's a tendency for us more, you know, to revert to type. So, you know, you don't generally get less stiff as you get older. You get a little bit more stiff. So, you're on this kind of journey with your body. And in my experience, people who are hypermobile, massive, you know, yoga teachers and Pilates teachers can be quite problematic to fit to a bike because they just simply move too much. You know, they're looking for end ranges. You know, they try and put their spine into full extension or a full anterior tilt, you know, slouch, because they feel comforted by, you know, end range. So with somebody who, for example, is hypermobile, you know, what you want to do is give them strength that gives them structure, which gives them a position in space to be. You said, so the advice of somebody who's hypermobile is different from the advice of somebody who is, you know, very, very rigid and then very, very stiff. So your listeners who are listening to this, again, they can now imagine themselves on that spectrum. Where am I on that spectrum? Am I super, super mobile? Am I, you know, a gold star yoga teacher, or am I somebody who's challenged by stiffness? So your challenges in terms of bike fit are going to be different based on where you are on that spectrum, if that makes sense. So for the hypermobile person, you know, we're going to try and get you to build up your strength to anchor you in space. For the super rigid person, we're going to try and make you as mobile as you can be to fold your body into this origami bike position.
Interesting. Good. I like that. Describing that being hypermobile can cause just as many problems as being super stiff.
Yeah.
So they're just different problems.
That's right. So hypermobile people can have lots of saddle problems, because saddle pressure is a function of two variables, really. It's a function of just simply how much pressure you're putting on the saddle and also how stable you are. So you might not have much pressure on the saddle. You're light, you're well conditioned, but it might be that you don't have much pressure on the saddle, but you're not stable either. So the instability is causing a shear stress on the saddle, hence you get saddle problems. So somebody who you think they shouldn't get saddle problems, you know, they're light, they're well conditioned, they're fit, they're strong, they get all kinds of saddle problems because they're not stable. They're not stable because they're hypermobile, they're too mobile. So, you know, you have to sort of try and think of your clients in this respect, you know, what's going on for them. And hypermobility can be as much of a problem as hyperstiffness.
I want to remind listeners, we're speaking with Phil Cavill. We are talking about his book, we're talking about fit, the midlife cyclist, the roadmap for the plus 40 rider who wants to train hard, ride fast, and stay healthy. And right back to fit. So I'd like to know how you see fit affecting speed. I know that everybody right now is talking about power output. I do not have a power meter on my bike. I do not want a power meter on my bike. Actually, I ride the back of a tandem. I almost never ride a single. My husband has a power meter on his single. But what do you see as fit affecting speed and power? What are the things that might prevent you from being fast and powerful?
Yeah. In a sense, I think if you're trying to produce power, as much power as you can, your limitations will be both your metabolic issues, you know, your body's capability, but also the interface with the bike itself. There's no point in trying to produce as much power as you can, but your saddle is 10 centimeters too low. Your body simply will just tire and fatigue really quickly. So, you know, so what Fit can give you is the resilience to produce power over a greater time and distance. So your body's ability to produce power is metabolic, if you like, you know, or it's physical, biological. But the interface where that biological becomes kinetic energy is all about Bike Fit, linking the two, linking your body to the bike. And that's where, if you're not careful, if your bike position's not superbly optimized, you'll be leaking power over time because you're not resilient to the forces that the bike's putting on your body. And that can be in terms of foot posture. It can be in terms of your saddle position, your bar position, your crank length. All these things come in. And they're very difficult for you to assess on your own. I can't do my own bike fit. It's just impossible. It's like doing my own, cutting my own hair. It's very, very difficult. So, you know, you need somebody, an honest kind of observer outside to look in and say, okay, this is what I'm seeing. This is what I'm observing. This is what I'm measuring. And so bike fit gives you that kind of resilience to the forces of the bike placing on your body. Because the bike is very dictating. It's a dictator. It tells you where your feet are going. It tells you where your hands are going. It tells you what range your hip is moving through. You know, and that can be really, really great, or it can be really, really awful. You know, if I put you on a 180 crank and put your saddle down low, you know, your body is trying to, is, you know, the bike and the crank is trying to stress your body beyond what it's capable of, probably, or comfortable with, most certainly. So it's about thinking around those limitations.
So one of the things I've run across, and I run across it in yoga too, is people who are now having things like hip replacements and knee replacements. And so, you know, I'm finding myself needing to add maybe a lift on one side because somebody's hip is dropping too much. Yeah. Or raising bars up. And I know there's, you know, so many people are saying, oh no, I love that racing position, and they can't figure out why they can't move their neck the next day. So I guess what I'm asking is, are all those things part of the fit process that you see today with that midlife and older rider, that you have to accommodate these kind of new things that are happening?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you have to have a conversation with the person. It's a, you know, the fit is a journey that you need to take somebody on. You need to kind of lead them by the hand and then go on the journey with them. And you need to in a sense, consider everything that goes into their bike position, their flexibility, their stability, their strength through their trunk muscles, every single thing, what their aspiration is, what their injury history is, you know, what hurts them, what niggles them after a 3-hour ride. You really have to tease out every single aspect of what the challenges are, measure them for yourself, and then start to make some recommendations. But take the person with you. It's a conversation. It's their bike, it's their body. What you don't want to do is start dictating what they should do with it. You want to make suggestions. You know, we use all the technology that we can in the Fit Studio, but, you know, I always say to clients, if it comes down to my data versus your subjective opinion, trust me, your subjective opinion is going to win. Because you're the person who's got to live with this when you walk out this or ride out this studio. There's no point in me telling you my data tells me one thing, but you don't like it. Well, that's not a partnership then. So, you know, that has to be the process that you go through with your bike fitter.
Let's take another short break and we'll come back to talk with Phil Cavell some more. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. We're speaking with Phil Cavell about all the things we need to be aware of as we age and still want to be strong, fit, and healthy. Oh, and ride fast as well. I want to talk about a couple more things and then move on to some opinions you might have about today's Peloton. What's your thinking about RPM cadence these days? I'm beginning to hear that maybe super, super high RPMs are not necessarily the answer to everybody's good quality cycling.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, I think we all came through that fast cadence revolution post Miguel Indurain. He was the first person, I think, to do that, you know, and then Lance obviously took it on. So we all kind of got swept away by it has to be 100 or it's nothing. You know, I definitely, in my personal opinion is, and it really is a personal opinion, is that for some people, low cadence works, you know, because the uphill leg is fighting gravity on every pedal stroke. So for some people, that fighting of gravity on the uphill leg is an uncomfortable process. So they want to do it as less as they can. So I'm very, very chilled about cadence. I think that some people can't control a fast cadence. The pedal stroke becomes a little bit dysfunctional. I'm quite happy to say to a client, listen, you know, you're spinning away here at 97, 98. It doesn't feel comfortable. You're bouncing off the saddle. It, you know, it doesn't look to me like you're in a harmonious position. Why don't we just take the cadence down to 80 or 85 or 90 and see how that feels. And for a lot of times that feels better for them. And I'm very relaxed about that. What I probably would do at the same time as that is I would probably shorten the crank and say, listen, let's try a 165 crank and then take, you know, then keep your cadence, you know, 90, 85, 90 with a 165 crank and see how that feels. Because you're minimizing the stress at the top of the pedal stroke. The hip is going less in deflection. You're creating room at the top of the pedal stroke. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that the conversations that I have with clients all the time, especially as they get older. As I get older, I use a 165. I used to race on a 172.5. I think those are all valid conversations now.
I don't know if you feel like this affects fit at all, but what about frame material? So I'm still from the old, I still love steel. And metal, let's just say metal, titanium, steel, maybe aluminum kind of is in there, but everything today is carbon fiber. Do you find that carbon fiber might not always be the optimum material for everybody?
If you're worshipping the twin gods of light and stiff, you kind of end up with carbon. If you're happy to have a more nuanced conversation around characteristics, longevity, comfort, a certain, you know, resonance and life, then other materials come into play, of which my favorites are steel and titanium. You know, I've got both steel and titanium frames. I've also got a carbon frame also, but, you know, I absolutely adore steel. I raced in it for decades, and I sort of feel titanium is its kind of slightly more sophisticated cousin. So I love titanium. If somebody really is determined that the only two things that they want is stiffness and lightness, then you're inevitably led to carbon because it ticks both those boxes more than any other material. Now, personally, those two criteria are important to me, but they're not the most important. Other sensations through the material are much more important to me.
I like that answer. That was good. Okay. So I want to talk about a couple more topics before we go. One is diet and alcohol specifically.
Yeah.
I know you talk about diet in the book. You talk about alcohol in the book, just a real kind of skip. I don't want to give the whole book away. I want people to buy the book. So, so just give us a little bit of an overview of your thinking on diet and alcohol.
Yeah. So your body, you know, so again, you got to think about your body is changing over time, you know, because we experience our bodies every day. You know, we get locked into this thinking that not even thinking assumption that our body's not changing. Our bodies are changing all the time. Our dietary requirements are changing all the time. So, I mean, I talk in the book about, you know, what you can do in terms of diet to try and optimize, you know, your performance. I won't give too much away there, but there are things that you can do around protein and protein consumption. Alcohol is a strange one. It's a controversial one, alcohol. And all I say about alcohol is in the book, and I'm somebody that, you know, previously did like, you know, a glass of wine or three. So I'm by no means a zealot here, but wine does seem to interfere with performance because it interferes with sleep. So it disrupts your sleep patterns, and that disrupts your recovery. And there's one thing that's massively important for midlife athletes, it's recovery. Recovery is a hard-won battle for midlife athletes. Recovery is the most important thing. And the way the body recovers, the way the human being recovers is sleep. You know, you if you want to optimize your performance, not to optimize your health, be careful when and where you drink alcohol if you're training. So it might be that when you're training for an event or you're training for a big ride, just think about cutting your alcohol right back, just for that period maybe, and then go back into your, you know, once you've achieved that goal, then fine. But in terms of mixing performance, recovery, and training in midlife, alcohol, I think, is a bit of a problem. And the research is coming out all the time about alcohol, and it's you know, it is a toxin. The body treats it as a toxin. It tries to metabolize it first before anything else. So I'm not proselytizing here in any way whatsoever. I would be the last person to do that. But I would say rationally, you may want to review your alcohol content if you're trying to optimize performance and health, if that's what you're trying to do.
The last thing I want to talk about has nothing to do with midlife. It actually has to do with talking about today's Peloton. So during the Tour de France, we saw a lot of crashes. There has been talk among bike fitters here in the US, and I'm sure in the UK also, that perhaps riders are riding bikes that might be too small, and they're ending up unloading the back end and loading the front end. And I'm wondering how you see if today's fit for these young, powerful riders, they're also being chosen for power output and may not have the handling skills that a Miguel Indurain or an Eddie Merckx or even a Lance Armstrong had. So what do you think about that? Are these bikes small? Can they lead to more problems in the Peloton when you're riding shoulder to shoulder and trying to be one of the top 10 in the GC?
Yeah, I need to be careful because I don't need too much persuading to start quoting back in the day, you know, this is how we did it. I mean, I need to be careful. I do have, like, I definitely have quite a retro gene in my body. You know, I really do. You know, I do look at the way, you know, I look back at Miguel Indurain and Stephen Roach and, you know, and I sort of think, my God, they look so elegant and natural on a bike. And so I need to be careful here. The modern pro rider, I mean, they're exceptional. I mean, in terms of the power they produce and the training and the nutrition and is exceptional. What I do see, and I don't know about the bike sizing issue, but what I do see is that a lot of pro athletes now, pro riders, seem to ride a long way forward. You see them riding in the Peloton, right on the front of the saddle. They're nowhere near the saddle. They're literally right on the front of the saddle. So their center of gravity is a long way forward. And then you have to start thinking about, why would that be? Why are they on the front of the saddle? And why is that, you know, what does that do to their bike handling if their center of gravity is so far forward? But then you also have to think that some of these new riders are just unbelievable bike handlers. Look at Tom Pidcock. I mean, just, you know, they, you know, I mean, just unbelievably talented bike handler. So I think we could be careful not to sort of put them all in one camp, actually. I do think it's an interesting question I'd never thought about before. It's a new question, which I think is very interesting. If riders are being selected on power output alone, not on a broader basket of skills, that's a really interesting question. I've never thought about that one, but it makes sense, doesn't it? That we're obsessed with this, and that's how we're kind of grading our new riders. I'd not thought about that, Diane, and I think it's a very interesting question. I'm going to ponder that one.
I'm going to let you ponder it. It's a great note to end our conversation on. Yeah. So the book is out. It is The Midlife Cyclist, the roadmap for the plus 40 rider who wants to train hard, ride fast, stay healthy. And it's by Bloomsbury, one of my favorite publishers. They tend to publish bicycling oriented books. And I have a wonderful contact there, Jessica. She's my girl. I really like the book. It's well written. I like your style of writing. And so where can listeners get a copy?
Yeah, well, so they can, I mean, all their bookshops, all the local bookshops, I think, are hopefully carrying it. I agree with you about Bloomsbury. They do really like their cycling titles. They're very loyal to cycling. Anywhere you buy your books, I imagine you can buy the Midlife Cyclist, or I hope you can at least.
Well, I thank you so much for taking time for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure. I hope to meet you someday and we can talk fit some more. Maybe we'll meet up with Ben, one of my favorite people on the planet.
Yeah, one of my favorite people on the planet also, Diane. That would be a great theoretical lunch, wouldn't it? You, me, and Ben Serotta. What a great lunch.
You got it. Well, thanks, Phil. Have a wonderful afternoon. Have a great rest of 2021.
Yes, thank you, Diane.
All right, you take care. Phil Cavell's new book, The Midlife Cyclist, is available at all the usual places. It's a great book to go back to again and again when you want to know about everything from biomechanics to diet in a really well-written manner. My thanks to Phil and to Brent Barber from the Bicycle Film Festival for joining me this week. Please remember that you can always join our conversations on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Instagram at Outspoken Cyclist, or leave a comment on our blog, outspokencyclist.com, where every show is accompanied by notes, photos, and links. Please like us on your favorite podcast app and leave a review if you are so inclined. Apparently, likes can turn into new listeners. Who knew? I'll be back next week with a brand new show, but in the meantime, please stay well, stay safe, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit outspokencyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.